Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cos podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to an emergency edition of the Macko and Cos podcast. And the emergency, I may OD on sports happy. I woke up at 5:45, still buzzing about the New York Knicks' greatest comeback in NBA Finals history. Hey, Bob, how you doing, old pal, old buddy of mine?
I reached out to you this morning, and I said, let's do an emergency pod, because I wanted to finally give you a chance to be happy in public.
It's about time. It's a about time this happens.
Just start us off. Literally the most amazing comeback in finals history and maybe just NBA history. Go for it, buddy. It's your team.
I'm going to do my best to talk in small portions.
No, go. Just
now. Well, here's the first thing.
Fire hose it.
The first thing is that this could be the greatest comeback ever just because of the stakes, because it is New York. They haven't won since 1973. It's in Madison Square Gardens. Trump is out. Taylor Swift is in. Larry David smiles, awkwardly high 10 someone. If the Spurs win, the series is tied at 2. They've got home court. You know, they seem like they solved all their dumb late game problems in game 3. And then, holy shit, they go, no, we didn't. In fact, we just got dumber, to the point where Charles Barkley afterwards said, this is the dumbest organization. This is the dumbest loss in the history of sports. I'm going to focus myself. Let's start from the beginning. Karl Anthony Towns gets 2 quick fouls. That looks just like how it was in game 3, but with Mikal Bridges, and suddenly the Knicks are down like 12-2. And right from the hop, Bob, it looked like game 4 was going to look like game 3.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
Okay.
You want me to jump in, but honestly, Matt, this is your day.
Okay. I'll mention, because I went back, and I'm going to read you some quotes during the game, and then after that we'll go back and forth more, because I'm worried I could monologue the shit out of this for the entire time Zoom allows us to talk. Mike Devin Vassell, awkward three-pointer. Spurs are up by 24. Mike Breen says everything's going the Spurs way. Moments after that, Mike Breen is mentioning that the largest comeback in NBA history was 2008 with the Celtics over the Lakers. And then finally, Bob, at the half, the majority of the time, it was Draymond Green and Shaq singing Wu-Tang, because Wu-Tang Clan was playing at the half at MSG, and they're like, fuck it. There's nothing to talk about. Let's sing Wu-Tang together. And they were having a gay old time. No one knew at that moment what was coming in the second half.
Do you have any guesses what happened?
Comfort. The Spurs got comfortable. And then the Spurs got dumb. That's what happened.
But usually, I mean, we've watched the NBA for decades now, and usually when a lead is that big, it's not that rare for a team to push it into the mid-teens, right? Because the winning team gets comfortable, all of a sudden 30 becomes 15 or 16, and you go, oh, well, it could become a game. But it almost never does. Because it kind of snaps the winning team out of its funk. The Spurs should have looked around when it got to 12 and said, oh, we got to, okay, now it's time to pull up our pants here. So the comfort thing I buy for them getting into it, but to actually come back 30 and to have only 30 points in a half, which is what the Spurs did, like that's almost impossible in the modern NBA. I'd be really curious to see a stat. How many 30-point halves have there been in the NBA in the last 10 years? So comfort explains part of it. Is it just the other part is straight-up dumbness?
The thing about cliches exist for a reason. They are based in truth. Then they metastasize. People use them, create stereotypes. It can become very offensive and used as a weapon. But at its base, cliches have truth. last night, the cliche of you don't win in the NBA when you're this young. That was in all its flaming cliched glory in that second half. That's what it was. They like Wembanyama and Harper. And of course, Castle, I can't believe he hit those two free throws with like 30 seconds left, which was a very mature moment. But I think it just came down to the young team went young.
I do think, even though this is Matt Day on the pod, we probably should point out that my prediction that you would take Jaylen over Wemby at the start of the season, if you were drafting players, that's aged pretty well, actually.
It couldn't have aged better. It couldn't. Like, Bob, you're a first growth Bordeaux. You're a Grand Cru Montrachet DRC motherfucker. You're an old Rioja that's 40 years old and still filled with fruit and power. In the fourth quarter, they cut the lead to one. How? A Brunson three-pointer. 2:17 left, 104-103. And then the Knicks' first lead of the game was moments after that, when it was a Brunson floater over Stephen Castle. Knicks with a 105-104 lead. Bob, you're so right. We can get into the Wembanyama failure in a moment. But again, it was Brunson and OG Anunoby. But those were the only two guys scoring for so much of the game. So yes, Bob, Brunson over Wemby. You smarter than everyone else.
Apparently. You know where it really hit me that Brunson was the man was actually, of course, at the end, and he hit like a crazy shot over Wemby's outstretched hand that we'll probably look at. It'll probably wind up a poster or a screensaver for somebody. But it really hit me in the third quarter because Brunson, even though the team looked out of it, was still hitting shots, was still pressing. He just had this vibe about him like he wasn't ready to give up. And the rest of the team followed him. And this is what we talked about with Jalen Brunson, is he's just the best clutch guy out there. He's the winning time guy. And whatever you need, like, God, he played 44 minutes and they threw everything at him. I don't know how he did that. He's only 6 feet tall. He's got these big guards like Stephon Castle, who's like the Ray Lewis of basketball. They're beating the shit out of him. They're throwing big guards at him, and he just keeps getting it done. We'll get to OG in a second, but I felt really great for Jalen Brunson because he took less money to be with the Knicks. He kind of said, hey, franchise, get on my back, which was a pretty audacious thing for a player who'd never had a franchise on his back before. And it's worked out so incredibly well. I don't know that we're going to look back at this time and say this was the Jalen Brunson generation, but I feel like he's carving out a special place in it.
He's the number one story in North America, mm-hmm. and the World Cup starts today. You mentioned the minutes, and you talked about there. You can do 44 minutes hard and easy. You can be three-point line guy, jog back and forth, and that's 44 minutes.
The Mo Pete Muskoka chair.
Yes.
From the corner.
Yeah. Just Mo Pete. I'm over here. I'm in the chair. When you want to throw me the ball, otherwise don't bother me. You can even be Steph Curry running around screens, and that's a physicality to it. But then there's the highest level where Brunson gets the shit kicked out of him. He's being guarded by Wembanyama all the time, and he still found a way to get it done. And he left $30+ million that Jeremy Lin mentioned, I think it was with Pablo Torre. He left $30+ million. And he's not afraid of the moment, of the pressure of being a leader. We could do a lot of Maple Leafs things right here, but we won't. But it's like just what Jalen Brunson did with all that degree of difficulty was incredible.
We showed before we get to Wemby and whether or not that was a failure or whatever it was that we saw. We should talk about OG, though, because he played pretty much a perfect OG game. 33 points in the end. Amazing defense. The crazy last second play, which we'll talk about today and probably forever. The block on De'Aaron Fox that kind of got the whole ball rolling for the Knicks in the final minute. And then afterwards, just kind of calm about the whole thing.
The calmness, his interview with Lisa Salters, yeah. You would have assumed they just won a game by 16 points against Brooklyn in February. He's just like, he was so matter of fact. Yeah, we have this belief. We knew we could come back. And it just, He could not have been more calm in that moment. The block on De'Aaron Fox, keeping it to a one-point game. But just how smart he was on that last second shot by Brunson, no one is looking at him. And he glides through all the Spurs and the athleticism and the intelligence. The athleticism to fly that high and the intelligence of reading the angle of the missed shot, tipped it in. I mean, my God, it's, think about this. When you look at the greatest shots in New York Knicks history, that might be it. The Knicks have been around for a couple years, and OG Anunoby might have their greatest moment.
You know what I thought of? I thought of Dwight Clark's catch in the end zone, where there's just a play, and this wasn't to win the whole title, obviously. Like, Dwight Clark's thing had even higher stakes. But the idea that you just want to watch this from every angle you possibly can, and that we're going to be seeing this play, especially because it's the Knicks, we're going to be seeing this play for decades. Like, this is going to be a defining play of this era of basketball. And I'm really happy it happened to OG. You know, he's just a good basketball player, a damn good basketball player, and he did a lot for Toronto.
He did. He was great with Toronto. He never had a moment when they won the championship because he was injured. By the way, for the young people out there, Dwight Clark catch in the end zone in the 1981 NFC Championship game, Joe Montana rolling out to his right and hitting Dwight Clark. Think about every year when the NBA Finals start, we get the montages. We get the montages of moments from the past. You could do Brunson and OG Anunoby, and you could cut up so many moments from these first four games and insert it to montages for the rest of time.
And this reminded me, this series, of the Dodgers and the Jays from last year, in that it wasn't just, you know, memorable, great baseball. There were just these crazy moments, like moments that could define a series. There'd be five of them in a game. And we seem to be getting this out of this series. Like, between this and the NHL, like, honestly, we talked about this last time. I can't remember a time I've seen high-stakes sports with so many incredible moments running concurrently. It's astonishing. Before we jump onto the Spurs, and I want to talk about Mike Brown, because he's not getting the credit he deserves. He's not one of these guys who's thought of as like a genius or a big personality. I think he's generally well regarded, but you know, Mike Brown just kind of felt like a standard NBA coach. But we'll never look at him that way again, because this team has been so good and he has pushed so many buttons so well, understanding how to read his team, read the moment. Can we just take a minute and celebrate Mike Brown? Because Thibodeau wouldn't have done this.
Well, no, there was guys that have contributed. Jose Alvarado hit a couple threes in that fourth quarter. Would he have had the confidence? Would he have even been on the court under Thibs? You know, they got more. Now, not as much bench production last night, but throughout these playoffs and in this series, they've had tons of bench production. That's on him. That's on Mike Brown. Mike Brown making adjustments when they were down 2-1 to Atlanta, making big-time adjustments at the toughest time of year. Absolutely. Mike Brown was a great assistant coach on some incredible, legendary NBA championship teams. But we don't – you know what's funny, Bob? We don't celebrate – the assistant coach in basketball the way we do in football. Oh, that offensive coordinator. Remember Buddy Ryan when the Bears won the Super Bowl? Well, Ditka was the coach. But the 46 defense by Rex Ryan. You know, we do this stuff all the time. So, yes, Bob, tip of the cap to Mike Brown.
So what do we do with Wemby now? Because, you know, the stats are good, and he's a kid. He's played, you know, the kind of defense that I don't think anybody's ever seen. I imagine watching Bill Russell back in the day must have been like this. In my whole lifetime watching basketball, I've never seen anybody influence a game defensively the way Victor Wembanyama can. How do we even see Victor in this series? Like, I honestly don't know. I'm honestly asking you, like, what are we supposed to take from this? Because I can't decide whether or not he's washed up before it started, or if it's just the sign of greatness to come because he's a kid and he's already this good. I honestly don't know.
It's the second one. Now, first about the defense. I hate when we say this is the greatest thing ever. I'll still argue John Elway is better than Patrick Mahomes. I will always do this. When someone says Shohei Ohtani is the greatest baseball player ever, I'm like, can we please calm the fuck down? I've never seen defense like what Wembanyama has been doing. Now, I've only been watching basketball since like the early 90s. I've never seen defense this good. I've never seen one person impact everything. It's number one. As for Wembanyama, I don't think I'm worried about his future. He is so good, but it needs to be brought up. Critical turnover near the end of game one. Dumb turnover and bad foul on Brunson in game two, and he missed the game-winning shot. And then yesterday, the thing is, yesterday wasn't about a moment. Yesterday was about 24 minutes of what the fuck are you doing? 1 of 5 shooting in the third, 2 of 8 shooting in the fourth, missing 3 free throws in the fourth. All those 3-point shots, and we can put blame on the coach, but it's also up to you, Wemby, to, like, there was one sequence where it was in the third where they took like 3 or 4 3-pointers in a row and they kept getting the offensive rebound and they just kept chucking up the threes. Like, Wembanyama, just an absolute choke job by him and the team in the second half. There's no other way of looking at it.
Is there, if you were to create like a stack ranking of who should have stepped up, Victor's number one. Is De'Aaron Fox number two?
Yes.
Because he's not like a vet, but he's been around a minute and he's supposed to be a clutch player. And his decision to drive on OG as opposed to just dribble out and run some clock and maybe get a couple free throws, it struck me as so dumb. Even in the moment, like, look, OG had a great play. He had a great play to block his shot. But there was that sense, like, and this is such a young person's way of looking at it. Oh, I can put this away. I'm just going to go right to the basket. I think I said after game one, they're going to need more De'Aaron Fox. And I didn't mean they need him to be good. I meant they needed him to be mature and run things. Do you remember we had this conversation?
Yep.
I did not get the sense anybody was running the offense. It was like that scene in Apocalypse Now at the bridge, where they have no idea who's in charge. I thought you were in charge. It was so rudderless. I'm going to make a case actually for Mitch Johnson after Victor Wembanyama was the one that we should hold accountable, because he's the fucking coach.
Oh, yeah.
He knows he's got kids. And if you drop 30 points, that's bad on the players, but that's bad on the coach too.
Absolutely. Mitch Johnson, him and De'Aaron Fox can fight it out for second. You know what? Maybe we should blame Sacramento. It's like, you could be a veteran, but if you're a veteran from Sacramento, maybe that doesn't mean you're a real veteran after all.
Well, I hope that's not true, because I think the Raptors are going to get Domantas Sabonis this offseason. So.
Subject for another day. Yeah.
Was it a depressing loss? Like, how do we even look at this? You know, because it's the biggest choke job in history, but they're this young team that made the finals. Like, I don't even know how we're supposed to read this, because I want to rip them, but then it's like, they shouldn't even be here. It's astonishing that they beat Minnesota and Oklahoma City on the way here. They're young. They're clearly exhausted. They're running into a freight train of a Knicks team. They're on the road in Madison Square Garden. I don't want to rip this team. I don't want to turn them into one big collective Ben Simmons. The loss was so bad. I don't know how to see this.
Like, I remember they were in the summer of the third, there was a shot of Dylan Harper and Stephen Castle. Mike Breen's talking about these guys are going to be around for the next decade. Yeah. I think what's going to probably happen is we're going to look back at this in 5-6 years and going, how did the Spurs not win more? When you look at the collection of talent on this team. And that's why it's not depressing, because depressing is usually when the team that chokes, you realize, oh, that was their only chance. You know, like when the Atlanta Falcons, when they were up 28-3 over the Patriots, you're like, oh, this might have been their only time. And that was proven correct. I think the Spurs are going to have so many more kicks at the can, but they're now just part of one of the greatest choke jobs in NBA history. That's the only way you can look at it. And also, it kind of reminds me in Avengers when Benedict Cumberbatch, and I don't know why I'm forgetting his character name right now.
Doctor Strange.
Yeah, Doctor Strange. Thank you. When, you know, Iron Man's asking, how many permutations do you see this working out? And his answer is, not too many. There's a million where we're going to lose. There were so many different ways where the Spurs should have won that game. And they went the one path where the Knicks were able to pull it away.
It would be the worst thing for the NBA if coming out of this, Victor Wembanyama's stock went down. I didn't think that was really possible going in because of who he is and how he's played and all of it. You know, I actually started a folder of Wemby stuff. You know, whether it was the dribbling up the mountain with the Shaolin monks, that he's starting a book club. Before game two, he's in Central Park painting. Like, I want to love this guy. Everybody wants to love this guy. But you list, like, the three losses. Like, he had a signature imprint on all three losses. I would hate it if we walked away from this and thought, he's great, but.
It's not going to happen. The
Are
only
you sure?
People. Yes, I am sure. And
I started getting texts from people already going, he just doesn't have it. Like, he's not a winner.
Well, he's so young. I here's the thing. Anyone, any mainstream media person saying, I don't trust this guy, they're doing it because they need the clicks or the story. Because here's the thought experiment. If and when the Knicks win the title, the moment all the confetti has been cleaned, ask everyone in basketball, who would you take first going forward? Who's not saying Wembanyama?
It's true, but it also puts him on the clock.
It does.
The clock has now officially started for him, and maybe prematurely. But if he goes out and stinks it out again, then people start going, well, maybe he's Alex Rodriguez. You know, one of the greatest players who ever lived, but not necessarily a great postseason performer. That's not true. Obviously, it's not true. He's had an incredible playoffs to this point, but some losses are so big, you don't know what to do with them.
Yeah, the more interesting story is, how does he rebound from this?
Yes.
You know, and I think sometimes, you know, we just have to remember he's like 21. Because he's so big and he can push around the 30-year-olds, you don't realize it. But, you know, there's moments when you could see he was in his own head. And it was just such a colossal letdown for him. And he'll wear it, and he deserves to wear it. But it also is the tip of the cap to how great he is that everyone was shocked he failed in the manner that he did. This is different than game one or two. You had two quarters to just go to the basket, to go and attack, and you didn't do it.
So there's two things here. One is clearly endurance and fatigue is an issue with this guy, because when they play every other game, when it's just 2 days, when they have 1 day rest, on that second game, he fades. And then when they have a little bit more rest, he looks really great all the way through the game. So clearly, endurance and fatigue is going to have to be something that he addresses. But there is something interesting. Like, I don't think it's as clear cut or clean as you say, because he keeps chucking up threes. And he's 7'5". And I haven't heard a single commentator, like not one, that said he does enough with his size. And maybe, like, there's, you know, I was thinking about Ralph Sampson, and this is another one of those 80s references, but Ralph Sampson with Hakeem Olajuwon, they were known as the Twin Towers back in the day. And Ralph Sampson came out of Virginia, and he was kind of like one of the original unicorns, because he was 7'4", but he kind of played like a guard. He had the opportunity to be in the pantheon of the greatest players of all time because of his skill set. Sound familiar? But he fell a little too in love with playing like a guard. And it kind of kept him from playing like a 7'4 player with an incredible toolbox of skills. And I wonder if this happens sometimes to unicorns, is that they don't actually learn the brute truth of just take your fucking skill and ram it down somebody's throat until they can't stop it.
You know who we said that about? LeBron James, first year in the finals with Miami, when he wouldn't go to the basket and wouldn't use his brute strength against J.J. Barea. Then after that, he developed. Kobe, one of his first playoff runs, was jacking up way too many shots against Utah, and he developed. So there's that path. There's the Ralph Sampson path, the Ben Simmons path as well, which is what you're getting to, Bob, because what you're bringing up is real examples of all NBA players where something short-circuited and it took him down a very different path.
It seems unfair, because he is so young and it's really his first playoff run, to suggest that he's at a crossroads. But he kind of, like, you can see the crossroads on the horizon. He may not
Correct.
be there right now, but the clock has started. And if he does this again and they underperform, if he doesn't seem like he's using his skill set right, people will be like, well, maybe mentally he just doesn't have it. And I don't think that that's true. Sports are filled with guys who are incredibly talented who never figured out how to make the most out of their own talent. And I would
Here's
like
a
to say that it's ridiculous, except Matt, they dropped a 30-point lead last night. He blew game one, he blew game two. He was a non-factor in the fourth quarter of the most epic failure in game four. Like, I'm not trying to case build against Victor Wembanyama, but I kind of am.
You know what though, but these are the facts.
They're the
These are
facts.
the facts. Yeah. These are loud, big mistakes at the exact worst time. It's now part of his story. You know what I wonder about, Bob? If he doesn't hit that Steph Curry like three-pointer in overtime of game one against the Thunder, if he doesn't hit that shot, is he taking as many threes? I mean, who knows what happens with that series, but it's like, you almost don't want, if you're a Spurs fan, you almost don't want Wemby to have success early hitting threes because it will take away that God-given talent that he has and size that he has.
It's almost like a quarterback who's young and scrambling and then like just finds a tiny opening for the wide receiver and hits it. And then they think that's a play they can make as opposed to a play that they just happen to make. And so they
Yeah.
look for it too often, or they believe that it's there for them when really it's not. It's a bad percentage play. And it's amazing that they did it. But one of the things I've really learned, there was in life, I've learned the success depends on the talent to manage your own talent. People get in their way all the time. What we see with Victor is incredible maturity and focus, and we're excited about that. He feels like 7-foot-5 Kobe sometimes, different in his personality, but similar in his focus. So I think all of this is going to go away. You just want him. I heard a great stat once. I'm kind of lily padding a little bit here, going from point to point, but somebody said once that people often do what they're second best at in life. Because they have a tortured relationship with what they're first back, oh good, best at. It's too personal for them. They tie too much of their own individual identity into it. So they wind up doing professionally second, the thing they're second best at. What Victor's best at is tall. You kind of just want him to wake up and go, oh wait, my feet are hanging 3 feet off the bed. I'm really tall. And then everything he should do should start with this sentence. I am tall on the court, therefore I should. And he does it defensively, but he doesn't do it offensively.
Maybe part of that is the conditioning because, like, I remember game three, he had like three dunks in the first couple minutes, but that there is a physical exertion to get there, to bang around. And maybe that's also a part of it. I think this is what it comes down to, Bob, about building a case or whatever. Wembanyama always felt inevitable. He still might be, but now we're saying might be versus will be. You know, that's the difference.
You know who doesn't feel like a young player out there is Dylan Harper. Castle makes dumb mistakes, and you said you've forgiven him his turnovers because of degree difficulty and all this. Like Castle is looks like your quintessential young prodigy trying to figure out how to make the most of his skills. There's something weird about Dylan Harper where it's almost like he seems like a 32-year-old in the body of a 20-year-old superstar. I would not be shocked if in 5 years, I mean, it's always going to be Wemby's team, but if Dylan Harper isn't the catalyst to winning for that team.
Or if Dylan Harper's even on the Spurs. But
He has to be. No, you would get rid of everybody but Wemby for him.
so I wanted to bring up this one note because we got less than 10 minutes left. Last night's game is also proof. Be careful about trusting the plus minus statistic. OG Anunoby last night, minus one. Jakob Poeltl in 7 games against Cleveland, plus six. Be very careful about that statistic.
As the great Talking Heads once wrote, facts all come with points of view.
I should also, because I was talking with our sponsor, Jeff Pollock, and if you need a lawyer, Jeff Pollock, that's Jeff with a G, jeffpollock.com. He had a criticism that there hasn't been enough duck conversation on the pod. Apologies to Jeff. I didn't, there's no duck talk, but Bob, one of my favorite things that I was cooking leading up to the game, I love taking a less expensive piece of meat, and this one's just like a beef tenderloin tip, you know, from No Frills for like $11, and just salted it, let it sit for a day, reverse seared it. And at the half, I thought that was the best part of my night, was that I nailed the beef tenderloin.
Well, one, that's awesome, because a well-cooked meal is a gift from God.
Yeah.
Two, as good as your tenderloin was, it couldn't have been as good as that comeback, which I'm sure you're...
I agree.
And it's weird that you bring this up, because we didn't discuss this. This being an emergency pod, we didn't have time to think about what would be on the show. I wanted to talk to you about food crimes. I thought about you last night because I went to a wedding. The food was delicious. And yeah, the two choices, fish and steak, as you'd expect. I got the fish. Fantastic. Blackened cod and miso. Oh, so good.
You wait, hold on. Miso cod, black cod at a wedding?
Yeah. So it was a small little affair for my brother-in-law.
Okay, because that's like fancy.
Oh, it was just fantastic. And the steaks were great and they were thick. They were like, you know, like baseball steak type cuts. And someone sent that back because they wanted it done well. And I thought to myself, is that the greatest of all food crimes? Well done steak.
It's the classic one. What is worse? I want my steak well done, or where's the ketchup I needed for my steak? That's the classic.
I'm going to argue the well-done steak is even worse because, you know, you might really like ketchup. I think it's a terrible crime, and we'll get to this in a second about ketchup and all the things it does to food. To take a great piece of meat and destroy it, like that's just fundamentally cruel. It's a food crime.
It is. It's a total food crime because you're robbing it of all of its flavor. You're robbing it of its purpose. You know, like I love rare, but if you need to go medium rare, fine. You know, I'm willing to adapt. But yeah, no, that is the number one food crime.
I wanted to, and then it got me to thinking, like, what are other things that don't just, like, you know, we all have foods we don't like, but you could see why somebody else would like them. But then there are things that nobody should like because it's just fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
Vegan cheese. Have you ever had vegan cheese?
It tastes like something that shouldn't exist.
It's weird because it comes from people who are kind of pure of heart, and yet it tastes artificial and weird. Just have none. Like, if you don't eat cheese because you're not doing dairy, that's fine. I get it. This weird synthesized shoe leather of a thing, vegan cheese, food crime. You know, it's another one. Fake lobster. I think fake crab can be done okay. Like, it's not my favorite, but there are ways to prepare it where you can kind of get through. But fake lobster just feels like a food crime, especially in a lobster roll.
Yeah, it's either you shell out for the real thing or just have something else.
And then, of course, there's the... Like, ketchup is such a tricky thing with food crimes because as great as it is, it also has the tendency to destroy stuff. I don't know how I feel about ketchup on eggs. And I think this is a bit like the pornography thing, which is I don't know when it's too much. Like, I don't know how to define it. I just know it when I see it. But here's what I've come to. I can live with ketchup and eggs, but you can't put the ketchup on the eggs.
It's a great compromise. A little on the side, but once you put it on top, now you've imprinted ketchup over your eggs. It's there to help if needed.
It's a question of degree. That's the problem I realized with ketchup and eggs, because ketchup and scrambled eggs is good together. I've thought about the guys that I worked with back when I was doing landscaping, going through university, and, you know, breakfast was so important because it was a chance to not work for 2 hours. And they knew every place, like in the city, every place. And this one guy, Gary, he would get his eggs at the Easy restaurant and, you know, he loved it. And he would get his ketchup and just fucking go to town and pour them all over the eggs. And I remember looking at it thinking, I want to barf. Like, this is terrible. Had he put it on the side, I think he would have known this is too much.
And by the way, good call for you by not judging him openly and loudly. That might have ended poorly for you.
You know, they hated my guts. They really did, all those guys. And actually, the guy who ran the crew pulled me aside and he said, they all hate you, but you can't take it personally because they hate everybody that they know is here for the summer.
Bob, by the way, I get why they hate you. You complain about fake lobster and you're going to the World Cup tomorrow. I can see why they hate you.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.